my woman.
This album is a bit of a surprise for me. Frank Turner's an artist I wasn't particularly familiar with, but heard him on the South by Southwest playlist this year. And it's like, that's kind of interesting. Not really my thing, but he seems really heartfelt. He's just a very earnest artist. And so we went to check him out.
Well, also we had multiple people that we talked to throughout the festival tell us, you run into people and you kind of chit chat and share information about who you saw that was good. And multiple people said Frank Turner was really great.
Yeah, and so we went, and yeah, he's incredibly charming and popular in a way that I had no idea. Like, that place was packed with people who knew all of his songs by heart.
They were super fans. There was some woman, it was her birthday, and he brought her up on stage and, you know, asked her to pick a favorite song that he would play just for her, and, like, she had one, and it was very surprising for somebody that I had never heard of.
Yeah, but he also is very kind of folksy and just a guy with a guitar. And so to open up this album and it's these ultra fake hand claps and organs, and then later there's a choir and something you thought maybe was a dulcimer
or maybe a harpsichord.
Yeah, but it's really full throttle. How many instruments can I throw at this song?
And very produced in a very like slick way.
It's super produced, a little too much. I said, the hand claps are so fake that I came into this and I thought, oh no, what am I getting into? But the earnestness is still there. Mm-hmm. And even though it's a song, like, don't worry. And you might think like, oh,
thank you.
is Charlotte Silver, and you're listening to Listen Local. It's been an exciting last couple of days, the first contested mayoral race in 15 years, and there's still no clear winner. So with us to discuss what happened at the polls on Tuesday, where the mayoral race stands, what happened with the propositions, is Mission Local managing editor and longtime San Francisco journalist Joe Eskenazi.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Charlotte. I appreciate it.
Yeah, very happy to have you help us understand what happened.
Well, we're all working it out.
Right. Still not clear. So let's look at what the most up-to-date count is. It's less than a 1,200 lead from Mark Leno
on second place votes, because San Francisco runs a ranked choice voting system. If you just go by a traditional system, what would have happened is London Breed had about 36% of the vote, and Mark Leno had about 26.5%, and Jane Kim was about 4.5% behind him. And, you know, in most cities, what would have happened is London and Mark would have gone to a runoff. We have what's known as instant runoff voting, where people put down their second and third choice votes, and as their candidates are eliminated, those votes transfer to the candidate of their choice. There was a tremendous carryover between Jane Kim and Mark Leno. Right now, it's about 76.9% of Jane Kim's second place votes are going to Mark Leno. That's unprecedented. It's amazing. It's beyond the projections of Mark Leno's own people. So the idea of Mark Leno winning on second place votes is not only not surprising, it's what his people were trying to do. The numbers that we're getting are surprising. They exceed what his people thought was possible by a lot.
And why is that, though? I mean, if I was watching the election, I would have thought that they would have expected that.
I don't think, I mean, it's a lot to expect people to get whatever message you're giving. And Mark and Jane Kim had a 1-2 message. Vote for me, number one. Vote for her, number two. Vote for me, number one. Vote for him, number two. And it was expected that, you know, a lot of people would just say, okay, I hear you, but I'm going to vote whoever I want for number two. Maybe that happened, but, you know, a strong correlation of people, a strong number of people from Jane's camp voted for Mark. And when it's all said and done, we can look at the ballots and see how many of Mark's voters voted for Jane number two. I would guess it's not nearly as high as 77%. But then again, 77% is just an astounding number. It's, you know, if you're a basketball fan, it's almost like the famous game between Georgetown and Villanova, where Villanova shot 78% in the game to win. It's theoretically possible to do these things. It just doesn't happen.
So there's still over 80,000 votes left to be counted,
which is a huge surprise to me and to everyone. Everyone, you know, all of the election professionals I talked to expected a turnout in the mid-30s, maybe 40. Mm. But, you know, if there really are 80,000 votes, and some of that is conjectural because it depends on how many vote-by-mail ballots are delivered today and tomorrow. Mm. We know that 13,000, 15,000 were delivered yesterday. But, you know, it depends on how many are delivered today and tomorrow. And that would be a bit weird, because if it takes that long to get delivered, it means somebody has a vote-by-mail ballot and delivered it from kind of far away. So that might be a diminishing return there. Anyhow, 80,000, 85,000 more votes, that pushes us up towards 50% turnout, which is, you know, kind of pathetic, but it's a lot for an off-season gubernatorial primary.
Primary in particular.
There's no draw, right? You know, I mean, think of it like a concert. You know, if you have some big band, you know, Radiohead or something, it's like, oh, well, then I'll come out to Radiohead and I'll see all my local bands and I'll vote for all my local propositions and whatnot, because Radiohead's on the head, right? And Radiohead would be a presidential candidate. But there's nothing like that here. Only 59% of San Franciscans so far even voted for Gavin Newsom for governor, which is kind of telling. It's not like people ran out to the polls to vote for Gavin. So 50% turnout is, while we can take a step back and say it's pathetic in the developed world, it's a lot. It's, you know, 34% is the average for these types of elections.
Okay, so I want to talk about why you think people turned out for this election. But first, just to clarify, 80,000, more than 85,000 more votes left to tally would make me think a 1,200 vote lead that Mark Leno has.
It's precarious, right now. Yes. Yeah. It's precarious. And, you know, anything could happen here. However, if you look at the trending, as you would expect, the votes that are yet to be counted are the votes that came very late in the cycle. Provisional votes from the day of the election, people who mailed in their ballots late. Mail-in ballots tend to be people who are on the left side of the spectrum. And they also would tend to go toward Jane Kim at least more heavily than disproportionately, let us say, because, you know, she had a real big get out the vote effort. These are people also who dropped off their ballots at their mail-in ballot. You just drop it off at a polling place, that kind of thing, right? A lot of people do that, you know. So this is not, this is science-y. There's some art and science in what I'm saying here. These are tendencies. Mm-hmm. People who vote early tend to be more reliable voter types. You know, they're homeowners, wealthier, more conservative-leaning by San Francisco standards. And those people voted for London Breed, and to a lesser extent, they voted for Mark Leno, and to the lessest extent, they voted for Jane Kim. What we're looking at now, almost above and beyond how many votes London gets and how many votes Mark gets, which of course is important, you're looking at how many votes Jane gets, because a vote for Jane is like 7/10 of a vote for Mark, plus his own votes. And that's what's happening here. So, you know, 1,100 votes is something that can change, but the trends, it would have to go against trends for London Breed to win this one. And so we'll see, you know, we'll see though. You know, the people who registered to vote day of election, we've never done that before. So we don't have science on that. Mm. You know, that could well have been, you know, London's people, you know, pro-housing activist type people. Were there 1,200 of them? I don't know.
Mm. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about what, you know, I know it's too soon to actually, you know, say that Leno has won, but
it very much is.
It is too soon, but I'm curious to just talk about the role of the mayor and how much power they actually have. Leno has run on a pretty progressive campaign. You wrote for the San Francisco Public Press, and that we publish also on Mission Local, about some of the kind of progressive accomplishments he's had over the years. I can read some of them.
Well, none of them comes in with a really strong executive record. Mm-hmm. Mark Leno has a good legislative record. That's not the same as being an executive. Jane Kim has been an effective legislator, you know, and you know, with all due respect, London has not legislated a whole hell of a lot, you know. So it would be, you know, on the one hand, you can kind of see how people would lead based upon what they've legislated. We can see what their priorities might be. We can't really see how they would lead. But make no mistake, there are some things a mayor can do and there's some things a mayor can't do. The mayor in San Francisco is very powerful. It's a strong mayor. But you can't build housing. You can only make it amenable for people to build housing, and you can do everything but what's in the law. You can lean on people. You can call them up in the middle of the night. You can beg, borrow, and steal. You can threaten. But, you know, the mayor can't build 5,000 units of housing. A lot of people, you know, I mean, that is one of the big issues, and rightfully so. But the mayor can only do so much about that, mm-hmm. can only do so much. So, and, you know, that's you know, you can't start printing money in City Hall, and you can't start altering the market in and of yourself.
So what makes the mayor in San Francisco powerful?
Because we have what's known as a strong mayor system. In places like Oakland, you have a city manager who does a lot of the things that a mayor does here. We changed the city charter, I believe, in 1996. That benefited a particularly strong mayor by the name of Willie L. Brown, Jr. The mayor hires and fires all the department heads. The mayor appoints the majority of most commissions, if not all of them. You know, the mayor is the one who, I mean, names the budget. The Board of Supervisors can haggle over things. But even, you know, and we can get to this with Prop C, which sets aside money for early childhood education, it's within the prerogative of the mayor just not to allot that money. So if the will of the people, you know, or 11 legislators, even 11, and Jesus Christ comes down from heaven and provides a 12th vote, and the mayor says, ah, not allotting the money, that's his or her prerogative. You know, you can, I mean, I always feel like there's a bit of disingenuousness in talking about, like, the limit, you know, some of the limitations of mayoral power, or rather, you know, saying it doesn't really matter who's mayor, it doesn't really matter what's going on in the city. It matters a lot. You know, look at the breaks that Airbnb has gotten, look at the breaks that Uber has gotten. You know, a line that I had in my eulogy for Ed Lee is that, you know, it matters what fights a mayor picks, but it also matters what fights a mayor does not pick. And, you know, Ed Lee is a different person than Mark Leno, who is a different person than Jane Kim, who is a different person than London Breed. You know, I frankly resent the implications by many people that every politician in San Francisco is interchangeable and that our issues don't matter.
Mm. I want to talk more about that in a little bit. But first, I want to talk about money in this election and the role it played, because there was a lot of spending.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like the candidates and the causes that got the most money didn't do very well or didn't do as well.
It's an interesting thing. You know, when I was a younger person, and I don't know how old the demographic is here on BFF.fm, but, you know, PG&E was able to dispel public power measure after public power measure to the chagrin of the Bay Guardian, which was monomaniacally focused on public power as the end of in and of it, you know, the end all and be all of everything that San Francisco was about would be solved by public power. You know, it was the holy grail of everything. And they lost again and again and again, even, you know, when you would think they would be inclined to win during the energy crisis of the early 2000s, because PG&E put tremendous amounts of money into bucking those measures. That didn't happen in this election, though it has also happened more recently. You know, the soda tax failed because Big Soda put so much money into it, and Big Tobacco is always active. This time they failed. They put a tremendous amount of money.
For those who don't know, Prop E, which overwhelmingly won to ban flavored tobacco. R.J. Reynolds' tobacco company spent $12 million
trying
to defeat it.
I remember looking at $12 million a month ago. Yeah. I think that it will come out, it will probably be double that.
Yeah, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, put $2.3 million to counter the tobacco company.
He's done that, and he also put money in to fight Big Soda. I mean, he wrote out million-dollar checks. You know, some of the biggest donations in San Francisco history, you know, are Michael Bloomberg, of all people. Mm-hmm. But you have one ballot measure, of which, you know, we had nine. Mm-hmm. One ballot measure sucking up, you know, toward $20 million more, you know, for something, you know, frankly, kind of as stupid as flavored tobacco. And, you know, and kids can go into Daly City and buy flavored tobacco. And, you know, who's dying on the hill of flavored tobacco? You know, I mean, you know, I feel for all the small businessmen, but if this is your business model, selling flavored tobacco, it's like, you know, why don't you just start poisoning your customers? But,
well, there's other big spending, Prop H, the police union proposition.
Orders of magnitude less. But, you know, but if you're looking at the trend here, the police officers union and other, I believe either the Chamber of Commerce or the Committee on Jobs, I'm not entirely sure which, also put money into this, getting toward $500,000 to not just give the police tasers, but allow them to use the tasers in the manner that the police union would see fit.
Right, with less training, less restrictions.
Yeah, more permissive tasing criteria. Uh-huh. You know, and that was beaten by a fairly ragtag and low budge effort from the ACLU and, among all things, the Democratic Socialists of America.
Right, so, like $41,000 to defeat it.
Yeah, I mean, this one I will admit, you know, and I put it in writing. I am very surprised. I thought that would win because I thought that most voters would look at that and just say, tasers are better than shooting somebody, without reading the fine print and seeing it's not just about giving the police tasers, because we're going to give them tasers regardless, because after a decade of wrangling, our police commission has said, okay, but the difference isn't whether they get tasers. They're getting tasers. The difference is what are the terms and conditions on when you can use the tasers and who has the authority to say that's good, that's bad, stop this, you know, change the policy, etc. It would be harder to change the policy if the union got its way, which actually, you know, quite sad, and not to be melodramatic here, that leads to deaths in other city. You need to be able to change the policy if things aren't working pretty quickly. So, you know, this, I thought for sure people would just say, hey, I like tasers. When you read the mailers that came to your house about Prop H, they were all very sensible. You know, they showed police officers, often women or minorities. It's like, I need a taser. You know, I deal with bad situations. It's like, yeah, of course she needs a taser. You know, this woman's 5'6". You know, like all that kind of stuff. If you didn't read the fine print, if you didn't read any media, you would never know the nuances of this measure. So I was surprised that it lost.
Right.
I was even more surprised that it lost big. Mm-hmm. You know, almost 60-40. Mm-hmm. So I got to say, like, I got this one completely wrong, so I'm not sure I'm entitled to explain why it won. In much the same way, the people who all along got the mayor's race completely wrong are now coming up with some very interesting takes.
So, I mean, it looks like potentially people got out, the progressives got people out to the
I would say that, polls. You know, maybe Jane Kim's voters have really swung this election in many ways. You know, that block of people seems to have voted, you know, if you look almost down, up and down the ballot, if the results hold and Mark Leno is your next mayor, almost everything that a left to very left voter would have wanted. They would have wanted Jane over Mark, but, you know, there was a trade-off there. It was one or the other. And you know, I spoke to Jane Kim's consultant and, you know, I pointed out to him, it's like, you know, Jane essentially, you know, again, assuming things hold, has delivered this to Mark. She's pushed him across the finish line. What's in it for her? And all he could say was, you know, this was her preference. If it wasn't her, it would be Mark, you know, because of, you know, what he said is, you know, the voters voted and decided instead of some billionaires. And that's just what you'd expect them to say. There must be some disappointment there. But getting back to my point, like almost every left-leaning measure won, almost, or at least what was at least what was the preference of the city's, you know, left-leaning establishment, and almost every right-leaning measure was defeated. I don't know. It's very hard to suss out, you know, what that means, but we can take that and just say that this is what happened, and we can figure out why, and we can figure out what it means, you know, as more data becomes available.
I'd like to talk a little bit about how this election was perceived from the outside, perceived and presented from people like at the New York Times, from people not in San Francisco, not even California. I'd like to hear your thoughts, your criticisms, how you think it was sort of misrepresented.
I think that the outside media did better than they usually do, but they made a lot of mistakes still. There were some outside media that kind of took campaign lines hook, line, and sinker from various campaigns without really thinking about it. There were some that presented, you know, London Breed not winning the role of full-time mayor as something that was of unabashed racism. Now, certainly, I think that nobody can tell people how they should feel. The people who are London Breed supporters are entitled to feel offended. That's their right. To put racist motivations into what was a purely political calculation is stretching things. I always thought, you know, there's perception and then there's reality, right? So we can talk about perceptions and reality. They're different. Also, I think that more pertinently, I feel like again and again, it's played up by either unknowledgeable or disingenuous people that there's not a whole lot of policy differences between the candidates, and therefore they're interchangeable, and therefore, like, I guess that we are going through a chain of thought processes here with the end result being, aren't we a supercilious and vapid people just all arguing here in our stupid little bubble while the country goes to hell? And, you know, frankly, it's a very dumb and insulting way of looking at things. You know, if you look at San Francisco politicians, the spectrum here is different than what it would be in Waco, Texas, or what it would be in New York City, or what it would be in almost anywhere else. But we are a big city, and big cities do tend to be liberal. And, you know, we have solved all the liberal ideological issues. You know, I don't mean solved as in like it's done, we've mastered it, but like we aren't arguing over the things that separate liberals and conservatives so much in, you know, nationwide. You know, this is not a vote between California and Idaho. It's a vote between California, you know, a municipal issue. What divides San Franciscans are municipal issues. And when we're looking at what people are motivated to go to vote about, you know, this is something that polling would be useful. And certainly, you know, I'm giving you a guess, but other people have answers here. But I would guess it's affordability. You know, it's transportation issues. It's housing issues. These are things that are not liberal or conservative. You can be very liberal and want to build lots of housing. You can be very conservative and not want those people moving in on your block. You know, like all kinds of things like that. So I think it's, frankly, at this point, because it gets done again and again, foolish to look at San Francisco's election through an ideological lens and try and make, you know, larger connections here to the way that Bernie Bros act in Vermont and the way that Democrats act, you know, vis-a-vis Keith Ellison or Nancy Pelosi is the spectrum of the party. That's not pertinent. You know, what's pertinent here are municipal issues and, frankly, if you believe Mark Leno and Jane Kim's people, access. Who has the ear of the mayor? You know, if you are tired of billionaires having, you know, doing what they want, then you probably, if this is a motivating factor for you, you probably didn't vote for London Breed, who has the funding of billionaires. If you feel that, you know, tech is good for the city, and if you feel that, you know, people who are arguing against that are kind of looking backwards through a rose-colored haze and ignoring a lot of filth and misery and underproduction of housing, you're probably more amenable to vote for London Breed. This is not a Democratic-Republican mm-hmm. issue. It's not ideological, mm-hmm. you know? So that looking at it through that lens is ridiculous. It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay, so we have a few minutes left. How much longer are we going to be waiting until we know?
A lot. You know, our colleague Mallory Newman was at the Department of Elections yesterday, and, you know, she sent us back the quotes, and I couldn't help but notice that Elections Chief John Arntz very liberally used the term weeks. Plural. He said we're going to be working weekends.
And we're going to be getting updates. We're going to be getting updates every day.
Every day at 4.
4 p.m.
And they're going to be working 18-hour days. They could work more, except they're worried the machinery will jam. You know, I mean, this is, if you think about this, this is a lot of work. And also keep in mind, if there is a recount, and, you know, if this is close, there will be lawyers and, you know, Bush v. Gore and all that kind of stuff. A recount's going to be expensive. And that has to be paid for by the candidate. So
whoever calls for it.
Yeah. Mm. And, but also, I believe that you have to have a criteria. It has to be within a certain percentage of votes for you to call for it. And every state has different rules. But, you know, not to put the horse ahead of the cart. Sorry, the cart ahead of the horse, rather. If this is close, it will get contentious. Mm. It will. You know, I've talked to some of the campaigns. They've already got lawyers that they've called up. You know, they're ready. You know.
All right. Well, Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
We got 5 minutes. You got?
Do we?
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
What do you want to talk about, Charlotte?
Well, I want to know what you think didn't get enough attention during the election.
I think that these are the things that we still could give attention to now. I think that, you know, if there is an upside to a never-ending count of the votes, we can start looking at the themes of the election. Among them, you know, the Democratic Socialists of America, run by two 20-something women, won on two ballot measures. That's kind of amazing, right? They won on Prop F, which will provide a lawyer for, assuming the mayor budgets for it, will provide a lawyer for people who are evicted. That's a big deal.
I have a question about that one. Why didn't the San Francisco Apartment Association put any money to defeat that? They were against it, but they didn't. There was no opposition financing.
There's only so much money. We know the Apartment Association gave $50,000 to the Sacramento PAC that's been disseminating money to fight Jane Kim and Mark Leno. So there's only so much money, right?
But having giving people facing eviction a lawyer is a
yes, it's going to be a big deal.
It's a big deal.
I don't know. I mean, the Apartment Association is a mercurial place, right? You know, if you are a left-leaning voter, they're not your friend when it comes to eviction issues, but they are your friend when it comes to Airbnb gobbling up housing. When you talk to the folks of the Apartment Association, they're nice folks, you know, and they would probably say, like, hey, you know, bad actors are bad actors. So I don't, you know, I could call them up now and ask them, but maybe they're thinking if you have a lawyer, you will have a more amenable outcome, and maybe it's for the best, right? Mm. Maybe we don't need to empower, the most rapacious evictors. Maybe that's their thought. Or maybe they just screwed up and maybe there's palms hitting tables in their headquarters right now.
Pick their battles.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's a worth a thought. We can, and but the thing is, we know them. We can call and ask.
Well, we should.
Yeah.
And it's also possible they spent some last minute funding.
It's possible, but unlikely. You know, last minute funding is not as useful. Particularly the type of person who would vote against that is an early voter. You want to get that message in. I would imagine that the vast majority of people who are running to the polls late are going to be, you know, left-leaning younger renters. And that's not a really receptive crowd to say you don't deserve representation when you get evicted by your landlord. So it's like, yeah, sounds good to me. So we'll see. We could call them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you could do that.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I should.
Yeah.
I have today free.
Yeah. You never tell your boss that.
Any other last-minute thoughts?
It's been a really strange election. I think that the media coverage was poor. I think that, for all the talk of how everyone was not energized and it fizzled and this and that, we got a much, much, much higher turnout than anyone was anticipating. And again, 50% is not something to bang your chest about because, you know, they'll vote much higher in other parts of the world. But, you know, it was way higher than anyone thought, including the principals who run these elections. So, I think that, and again, I'm not going to say I'm not immune to this, to be fair. A degree of introspection is due from the media apparatus in this city as to did we cover this election properly? Did we pick up on things we should have? You know, if I'm surprised by this, is it because it's surprising or because I didn't know enough? Mm. These are all questions that we should be asking
all right.
ourselves as journalists.
All right. Thank you so much, Joe.
And let me very...